This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high-quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of July 13th through 19th, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Governor Maura Healey on Thursday proposed capping concert and sporting event ticket resale prices, pitching the measure as a way to protect consumers from price gouging and deceptive practices that have made attending live concerts increasingly expensive and out of the question for many fans. But even before lawmakers begin to review the proposal, a ticket industry trade group says the legislation would leave untouched the part of the market where most ticket prices are actually set. The plan to add consumer protections to the secondary ticket marketplace, which will be included in her upcoming closeout supplemental budget, caps the resale price of concert tickets at 110% of the price of the face value of the original ticket. It would also limit the service fees and charges that can be imposed by ticket resellers like StubHub and SeatGeek to no more than 10% of the ticket price. For example, a ticket originally costing $100 could not be resold for more than $110. Brian Berry, executive director of the Ticket Policy Forum, whose members include StubHub and SeatGeek, said the bill regulates only the secondary resale market while exempting original ticket sales, which are typically handled by Ticketmaster and cover about 90% of all ticket sales in Massachusetts. He argued that dynamic pricing and other practices in the primary market are a larger driver of affordability than resale listings. If you listen to the governor today, she was clearly talking about all tickets, and it's really important that they fix this, Berry said after Healey's announcement. Disappointingly, the price cap only targets resale and does nothing to curtail Ticketmaster raising box office prices through dynamic and platinum pricing. That is how Ticketmaster takes advantage of fans. Days after meeting New England sweetheart Noah Kahan backstage at a sold-out Fenway Park show, Healey invoked the folk singer to announce the proposal at the State House on Thursday. Healey described the familiar scramble of recruiting friends and family to join an online ticket queue, striking out, then turning to resale websites, only to find prices equivalent to half a month's rent, or worse, discovering the ticket was fake. We know this happens a lot. It's infuriating, it's unfair, and it just costs way too much, she said. Standing behind a rostrum, Healey picked up a red phone adorned with a ladybug symbol, an icon used in Kahan's ongoing tour. A pre-recorded video of Kahan appeared on a screen to her right, and he supported the bill in a phone conversation with the governor. Artists alone could not tackle the market manipulation of secondary resellers, Kahan said. The proposal also would prohibit speculative ticket sales, ban deceptive ticket-selling websites and misleading marketing practices, and allow artists or venues to authorize a higher resale cap through a written agreement. We want to put control in the hands of the artists here, Healey's chief legal counsel, Jesse Boudou, said. We think it should be up to the musicians to decide how much it costs for their fans to come see the event, not up to the resellers. The governor's office said many resale platforms currently charge service fees of roughly 20% or more, adding hundreds of dollars to the cost of tickets. The language closely mirrors legislation filed by Senator Dylan Fernandez, who joined Healey Thursday and said soaring resale prices have put major concerts and sporting events out of reach for many fans. Fernandez at Kahan and Fenway Park priced tickets for the singer's recent sold-out shows between an average of about $125 and a high of $400. But that resale listings on StubHub range from $900 to $3,900. Soccer fans who have flocked to Massachusetts to watch the FIFA World Cup matches at Gillette Stadium, temporarily renamed Boston Stadium, are also facing steep resale prices with tickets for some matches starting at upwards of $1,000. The Falmouth Democrat said he plans to file the ticket resale language similar to the governor's as an amendment to the Senate's Economic Development Bill, which is expected to reach the Senate floor next week. He said during Thursday's press conference that the bill is good for the state's economy and cultural sector. This is really important economic driver for smaller venues and smaller artists as well, because people only have so much money to spend on leisure activities like concerts, and so they may have $1,000 to spend a year on this type of good that they're buying. But if they spend it all going to see Noah Kahan, and 60% of that, $600, goes to the scalper, that's money not spent on lesser-known artists at possibly smaller venues, he said. Barry, however, agreed that the proposal addresses only a fraction of the ticket market. The vast majority of time in the United States, that is Ticketmaster, he said, describing how Live Nation-promoted tours are frequently sold through Ticketmaster, which can use dynamic pricing and platinum pricing to increase ticket prices before they ever reach the resale market. Because the bill does not touch on original ticket sales, which Barry said constitute 90% of all ticket sales in Massachusetts, he said Ticketmaster and venues could continue raising prices, while resale platforms would face new restrictions. At its core, it is a glaring hole to leave the company that sells 90% of tickets in the state out of these price restrictions, he said. Barry said that the Ticket Policy Forum supports provisions banning speculative ticket sales and deceptive ticket-selling websites, but argued that if lawmakers want to improve affordability, any price regulations should apply equally to the primary and secondary markets. He also said the bill lacks a clear mechanism for verifying original ticket prices, which platforms would need to comply with the proposed resale cap. Informed of some of Barry's comments and asked about Healey's proposal, a Ticketmaster spokesperson responded, "We support legislation that addresses the real issues in ticketing, predatory resale sites, and scalpers who scam fans and siphon millions from the live event experience while contributing nothing back. That's why we support banning speculative tickets, ticketing, and efforts to cap concert ticket resale prices." Coalition for Ticket Fairness, another trade group that says it represents fans, season ticket holders, and small and medium-sized independent ticket businesses, also warned, at a time when Attorney General Campbell is fighting for stronger competition, this proposal risks moving Massachusetts in the opposite direction. Campbell spearheaded a successful antitrust lawsuit against Live Nation / Ticketmaster, resulting in an April 2026 jury verdict that the company operated an illegal monopoly. The proposal will allow Ticketmaster to raise prices unchecked, make it harder for fans to resell tickets they own, and stifle competition from responsible small and medium-sized businesses that provide buyer protections and consumer choice, the coalition said in a statement. Asked about the Ticket Policy Forum's criticisms, Healey's office said the primary market is where artists, venues, and promoters determine the price they want to charge fans, while the secondary market is often where massive markups happen, without additional money going to artists or venues who created the event. The administration said their legislation is designed to crack down on resale practices, and they also support efforts to improve transparency and affordability in the primary market, including through Campbell's work. They added they will continue elevating additional consumer protections there. Asked by a reporter at the press conference whether she had spoken with major resale companies, Healey gave a short yes. She later expanded, "We reached out to them. We told them what we're doing, what we're proposing. We ask that they support us as companies not looking to gouge people in Massachusetts." The Massachusetts unemployment rate fell another one-tenth of a point to 4.4% in June, and employers added 8,400 jobs last month, according to preliminary data the Executive Office of Labor and Workforce Development released on Friday. The Labor Office also adjusted its estimate of May jobs to a decrease of 4,100, down from the original reports of 2,900 jobs lost. According to data on the Labor Office's website, there was job growth in June in private education and healthcare, up 5,900, construction, up 3,700, and professional and business services, up 2,300. Sectors with job losses last month were trade, transportation and utilities, down 1,600, and other services, down 1,200, information, down 500, leisure and hospitality, down 300, and government, down 300. The U.S. jobless rate dropped to 4.2% last month, down from May's 4.3%. Massachusetts has added more than 24,800 payroll jobs, including 21,700 private sector jobs since September, the state said. Massachusetts' labor force participation rate fell to 65.3% in June, down from the 65.4% reported in May, according to labor officials. Last month, the labor force fell by 6,000, including 500 fewer people employed and 5,500 fewer unemployed. Labor officials say retirement is driving declines in the labor force participation rate. The U.S. labor force participation rate was 61.5% in June, according to BLS data. Two Cambridge progressives facing off in a rematch after a tight 2024 race sparred Tuesday in a debate that pitted an incumbent running on 14 years of policy achievements against a challenger casting the race as a referendum on what they say is an opaque and slow-to-change legislature. At a gathering where the remarks grew increasingly personal, Representative Marjorie Decker, who has represented the 25th Middlesex District since 2012, repeatedly argued that her opponent, Evan McKay, was campaigning against the legislature as an institution rather than making a substantive case against her own voting record. I'm not sure if my opponent is running against the legislature or me, because when I listen to my opponent is actually talking about all the things that I work for and actually deliver on, she said. And then when I don't deliver, I go back and fight for more. The race is a rematch between Decker and McKay, a Sierra Club leader, union leader, and JD PhD student at Harvard University, running as an anti-establishment candidate at a time when dissatisfaction with the legislature is running high. McKay nearly beat Decker in a 2024 primary contest to represent the mostly urban district located entirely within the city of Cambridge. Both in 2024 and in this election cycle, McKay has taken aim at Decker's ties to House leadership. Decker chairs the Joint Committee on Public Health. The state legislature, the state House of Representatives, has a lot of room for improvement, where they pass the fewest number of bills of all 50 states. They ranked dead last in government transparency, and every prior Speaker of the House since the 1990s has been indicted and convicted of corruption or an unindicted co-conspirator, McKay said. The debate hosted by Cambridge Day touched on economic growth, the climate crisis, and the shortage of affordable and available housing in the city. The candidates largely agree on many policies, including supporting rent control, investing in renewable energy, and responding to Trump administration cuts to science and research that fuel Cambridge's economy. However, they were quick to point out differences. Unfortunately, our state legislature last session, the state legislature works very well for large multi-state corporations and the ultra-wealthy who make big-time political contributions, and the state legislature passed a single sales factor tax cut for large multi-state corporations instead of small businesses, McKay said. This is something where my opponent could have introduced an amendment to repeal this, or get this out of the omnibus package. Decker said she was responsible for wins that put more money in working people's pockets. When I got in, that bill was my fourth increase for the earnings tax credit for people who work hard, but yet don't make enough money. I was able to increase the family tax credit and remove the tax cap so that every child in the family can actually be credited with money, she said. The seven-term Democrat described herself repeatedly as fighting, including sometimes against House leadership, contrary to McKay's portrayal of her. Decker also took digs at her opponent. I am out there fighting to make our lives better. And what I know is that complaining about it is not enough. The Cambridge Day moderators asked each candidate about public perceptions of themselves, describing McKay as impatient, if not unrealistic, challenging the status quo, and Decker as a pragmatist, and to some critics, you are sometimes spoken of as a secretive insider. McKay embraced the description of impatient, saying the housing crisis is something that we need action on. The child care crisis, the cost of elder care, an economy in which people continue to profit off of our misery. On the description of them as unrealistic, McKay said, I don't think that it is unrealistic to think that here in Massachusetts that we could be better than dead last in government transparency, that our state legislature could do more than pass the fewest number of bills of all 50 states. Decker also welcomed one of her descriptors, considering pragmatic to mean she can get things done. My opponent doesn't run against my record. They run against the legislature because they know that I've been out there fighting corporate interests. I've been fighting the interests of health insurance companies. I fight my leadership. I work with my colleagues. I actually can't legislate as a party of one. I have to work with advocates, community members, and be informed that my priorities are your priorities, she said. In one particularly heated moment, Decker shot back at McKay, who said, We need to address the ways that the ultra-wealthy have more access and influence on Beacon Hill than do ordinary people. Earlier in the debate, McKay said Massachusetts is the only state in the country where the legislature, governor, and judiciary have all exempted themselves from public records law. This is how laws are being formed. This is about who is in the room when these laws are being written, and the people with the most money and influence are able to pry their way into these closed doors, McKay said. Decker responded that she grew up in public housing in Cambridge and was never supposed to be in the halls of power. There's very few people up there who have my lived experience who are up there and willing to use their political capital. So telling me how I should use my time and what I should be fighting for and pretending that my record doesn't exist is insulting and is about trying to confuse you, she said to those in the room. And that's been the theme of my opponent's campaign. The candidates were allowed to submit one question each for their opponent. McKay's campaign asked Decker about her second job at class action law firm Berman Tobacco, where she reportedly earns about $100,000 a year on top of her taxpayer-funded salary of $126,519 last year. Decker replied that she has had to work two jobs most of her life to afford to live in Cambridge and is really proud to work for a law firm that fights against big pharma and corporate interests. She continued to fire back, "Not all of us can afford to be sent to Harvard for 11 years and then take a break while we campaign." McKay responded, "In this response, we did not get to hear what happens at this law firm or how Cambridge residents are able to see whether there are conflicts of interest or how these are handled, how much money happens there, the weekly time commitment." For Decker's question to McKay, "You spent the last decade as a student and were previously registered Republican. Why should voters believe that you understand the challenges they face and would be more effective at making a difference for people?" The challenger responded first to the question about their previous registration as a Republican. McKay grew up in a very conservative part of Florida, they said, a state that has closed primaries. Being registered as a Republican allowed them to vote in the primary, as there usually were not multiple Democratic candidates in any one race. At the one BLM rally that happened within the hometown that I grew up in, we attended outside the county jail, and racial justice organizers told people to register to vote as Republicans to be able to vote against the Republican sheriff, McKay said. McKay said they are a teacher, a mentor, an advisor at Harvard, but would leave those jobs if elected on September 1, because I want to be fully committed to all of our neighbors here in Cambridge. Tuesday night's debate was the third scheduled between McKay and Decker. Cambridge voters now have about 6 weeks to contemplate their votes ahead of a primary that is viewed by many as a microcosm of a larger debate on Beacon Hill. Senate Democrats unveiled a $325 million economic development bill on Thursday that installs guardrails for AI developers, enables duplex construction by right on all residential lots, gives municipalities control over the volume of available alcohol licenses, and tackles safety regulations for scooters and e-bikes. Slated for full consideration Wednesday and Thursday, the legislation incorporates $100 million for the defense sector, $75 million for AI development and application, $25 million for robotics technology, and $100 million in bridge funding to support research at public higher education institutions that are facing federal cuts. The Senate Ways and Means Committee polled members on the bill Thursday morning. Cities and towns must currently petition the legislature to expand the availability of alcohol licenses for on-site consumption at bars and restaurants. The Senate Ways and Means bill would instead enable municipalities to set their own caps. Under the bill, major AI developers, described by senators as large frontier developers, must publish safety frameworks aimed at reducing risks of potential catastrophes and critical safety incidents, according to a Senate fact sheet. The Attorney General could sue developers for violating the safety requirements. "These guardrails will keep us safe, but also keep us competitive," Senator Barry Feingold, co-chair of the Economic Development and Emerging Technologies Committee, said during a press conference Thursday in the Senate reading room. The bill also calls for a new commission to focus on AI regulation and safety issues, such as hiring third-party auditors to ensure compliance with safety frameworks. In an effort to alleviate the state's housing crunch, the bill allows for automatic two-family zoning. Senator Julian Sir, co-chair of the Housing Committee, called the provision a simple but incredibly meaningful reform. "Duplex is a part of what we often call missing middle housing, and we've been missing it for quite a while," Sir said. A bill summary says duplex provision vastly expands the potential number of housing units in the state, while also noting the new allowance is subject to reasonable limitations related to septic requirements, site plan reviews, and local guidelines and size limitations. Echoing the House's approach to regulate micromobility devices, the Senate bill sets safety standards for safety equipment like brake lights and helmets, as well as age limits depending on a device's speed capability. Governor Maura Healey wants bars and clubs to be able to stay open later, for longer than just the summer pilot that ends in 2 weeks. Trying to shake off Massachusetts' reputation as boring in the presence of international visitors for a host of summer events, the governor and legislature authorized a temporary 2-month extension of last call for bars in June and July. The law allowed bars to extend last call an hour beyond their license limit, until 3 a.m. at the latest, and allowed for public alcohol consumption districts through July 31. Both required individual municipalities to opt in before the measures could take effect. Lawmakers pitched the bill as a way to make the most of an influx of international visitors this summer for the World Cup held in Foxborough, creating an opportunity for local businesses from increased foot traffic and more spending on later nights. About 6 weeks into the experiment, Healey declared she wants it to continue. I used World Cup as an experience, as an opportunity to say we should extend bar hours, which we did, and I was glad to see that. So I'd like that to continue, she said Friday on WEEI Sports Radio. She also recently threw her support behind reviving Happy Hour in Massachusetts. It's about vibe and energy, she said Thursday. I'm really focused, as you know, on keeping 20-somethings here, keeping our young people here. All around, the governor said the summer, during which Massachusetts has hosted World Cup games, 250th and American Revolution celebrations, and the tall ships fleet, has been an economic boost for the state. I also knew we could pull it off. People like to be negative naysayers about how this whole thing was going to go. We had fantastic public safety, no issues through World Cup, MA-250, now the tall ships, she said. We also had great public transit that was working, the happy energy, vibe, joy, showing off Massachusetts. She added that she has heard from international visitors that they plan to come back. People told her, she said, you were welcoming, you were warm, it was fun. We're coming back. We're coming back and we're going to bring our families back. And maybe this time we'll get down to the Cape. It's going to have a lasting positive economic impact for our state, for sure. Embarking on a new political pursuit after she failed to gather enough nomination signatures for lieutenant governor, Anne Brinsley announced on Friday that she now plans to launch a write-in campaign for Secretary of State. Brinsley in May blamed her paid signature collector, Joe Bronski, for a shortfall in required nomination signatures, saying he collected signatures she thought were fraudulent. The Wayland attorney then shifted to a write-in campaign for lieutenant governor. Brinsley on Friday said she is now seeking to run the office charged with overseeing elections. When I entered this race, I believed Massachusetts had a secure election system. After experiencing the ballot access process firsthand and meeting with Republican activists, Democrats, independents, and town clerks across the Commonwealth, I have come to a different conclusion, Brinsley said in a press release announcement. Our ballot access process has serious weaknesses that can be manipulated by bad actors. Election integrity does not begin on election day. It begins with the process that determines who appears on the ballot. The campaign is about restoring confidence in our institutions, Brinsley said. Today's ballot access system has become a multi-million dollar industry. When outside firms are rewarded for collecting signatures as quickly as possible, incentives can become misaligned, she said. If our laws allow bad actors to exploit weaknesses in the process, then those laws need to be strengthened. If elected, Brinsley said she would boost access to public records, modernize the corporations division, make it easier to open and grow businesses, and work with the legislature and the next governor to reduce unnecessary costs and barriers facing entrepreneurs and small businesses. Brinsley must secure 5,000 write-in votes in the September 1 Republican primary to secure her spot on the November ballot. Secretary of State William Galvin is seeking a record ninth term. Galvin has easily fended off primary and general election challengers, never earning less than 64% of the vote in a re-election campaign. Brinsley was a Republican Party's endorsed candidate for lieutenant governor. She was born in Honduras and adopted at a young age and is CEO of Devco North America, specializing in alternative asset management and real estate transactions. Brinsley's LinkedIn page shows she is also CEO and founder of FX Wise Risk, which provides foreign currency solutions for businesses of all sizes. Brinsley was elected to the Wayland Select Board in 2023, and her term expired April 30th, according to town records. Anne Brinsley brings a critical voice to this race, and the Mass GOP will assist her in her efforts to achieve the necessary write-in votes for Secretary of the Commonwealth, Amy Carnival, chairwoman of Mass GOP, said in a statement Friday. The roster of six lawmakers who will be responsible for bridging a wide divide and crafting compromise energy affordability legislation is set. The House on Thursday named Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy Committee Chairman Mark Cusack of Braintree, Ways and Means Committee Chairman Aaron Mitchelowitz of Boston, and Minority Leader Brad Jones of North Reading to negotiate on behalf of the House bill. The Senate followed suit in the afternoon, naming TUE Committee Chairman Michael Barrett of Lexington, Majority Leader Cindy Cream of Newton, and Minority Leader Bruce Tarr of Gloucester to represent the Senate approach. Senate leaders predict savings of more than $14 billion over 10 years if their bill becomes law, compared with the roughly $9 billion over a decade the House claimed for its version. Energy policy negotiations have been among the trickiest for lawmakers to settle in recent sessions, and the divide between this year's bills poses a daunting challenge as the differences go deeper than the savings estimates. The major differences are around the future of the Gas System Enhancement Program, funding for the Mass Save Efficiency Program, and the extent to which savings should be extracted from utility companies. When he introduced the Senate bill last month, Barrett pointed to six parts of it that he said will save ratepayers the greatest amount of money. The House bill included only one of them, he said. GSEP was not a target of the House bill, but the Senate bill aims to phase it out entirely by 2030. While the House bill seeks to cut about $1 billion from the Mass Save budget, the Senate instead makes mostly administrative tweaks to Mass Save while leaving its funding level untouched. Ratepayers are eager for relief. Bay State electric bills have climbed from roughly $130 to $160 a month a decade ago to a peak around $250, while a typical winter gas bill has jumped from about $140 to more than $320, according to utility filings with the Department of Public Utilities. Authors of the House and Senate bills have not estimated near-term savings or when the ratepayers will see relief. Governor Maura Healey, who filed her own energy affordability plan more than a year ago and faces re-election in November as heating season picks back up, is also eager to sign an energy affordability bill and has said she wants one shipped to her desk by July 31. The Massachusetts Nurses Association wants state public health officials to investigate potentially unsafe staffing practices at Bay State Franklin Medical Center following cuts to patient services. Teresa Hudson, Associate Director of the MNA's Division of Nursing Health and Safety, lodged a complaint on behalf of Bay State Franklin nurses with the Department of Public Health on Tuesday over the Greenfield Hospital's decision to eliminate patient transport services during the 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. time window. Non-licensed staff typically transport patients throughout different units and services at the hospital, but now nurses, including those in the emergency department, must leave their posts to move patients around. In the emergency department, each patient transport to services like an MRI, X-ray, or ultrasound can take 15 to 20 minutes, which Hudson said limits the department's ability to respond promptly to patient needs, changes in condition, and emergency situations. Insufficient patient transport resources may lead to rushed transportation processes, increasing the risk of patient falls, equipment disconnection, communication failures, delayed recognition of clinical deterioration, and wrong patient events, ultimately compromising patient safety and quality of care within Bay State Franklin Medical Center, Hudson said of transfers to inpatient units. DPH spokesperson Omar Cabrera said the department received the letter but cannot provide any information at this time as it reviews the complaints within the letter. Bay State Health said it adjusted patient transport hours to be consistent with its two other community hospitals, Bay State Noble Hospital and Bay State Wing Hospital. These new operating hours allow us to maximize our dedicated patient transport resources and leverage support staff just for safe care, Bay State Health said. Bay State Franklin nurses overwhelmingly voted in mid-April to authorize a strike of 1 to 3 days, and last month they rejected Bay State Health's best and final contract offer, the MNA said. The union said nurses and Bay State Health have since reached tentative agreements on competitive pay, though the stalemate continues over safe staffing levels and affordable health insurance. In her letter to DPH, Hudson questioned whether Bay State Franklin is complying with state regulations, including safe hospital operations and sufficient staffing volume across nurses and ancillary staff. We believe this operational change has significantly increased the workload of clinical staff, reduced the availability of nurses and other personnel to provide direct patient care, delayed necessary patient movement and services, and created avoidable risks to patient safety throughout the hospital, Hudson said. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts State House News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of Central Massachusetts.
You are listening to Audio Journal, part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Thanks for listening. We have more programming coming up next.